Otherwise, I will do an extra recording afterwards. Okay, so if you don't mind, Juan Carlos, I'm going to, since now it started recording, I'm going to go through quickly again to the introduction. And just, I was just saying, because it didn't record first, that, thank you, that in this session, we are going to go through the main concepts and the main ideas of Unit 2 of the book. And of the course book, you also have this unit, as you know, in the course available, of the course Aplicaciones Semánticas de la Lengua Inglesa. I am the lecturer of this course, Ana Ibáñez Moreno, a teacher of the Faculty of Philology of UNED. In this session, we will deal with words and word boundaries. Basically, we will deal with morphology and the basic morphology, concepts of morphology that are involved in the building up of databases, lexicological databases, etc. So we will see basic notions about the different levels of linguistic analysis, the interaction of morphology and semantics, and these morphological notions that are important to understand word formation phenomena. I was saying that this is important because nowadays there is such an incredible amount of corpora, thesauri, lexical and conceptual databases, terminological databases, all types of corpus analysis applications that we would need 100-year lives and 100 to live 100 times to get to know all this. So what do we do in this course? We give the basic notions and the basic tools, the basic concepts that you can need to have a criterion to understand how these databases work. When you research, you choose for one, for instance, to do your master's thesis or your bachelor thesis or a PhD, or maybe in a future job, at least to have these notions. I was saying the metaphor of the recursivity of language is that with a limited number of elements, which is the letters, we can create an unlimited number of sentences in language. This is what Chomsky mentioned, and Saussure also in the beginning of the 20th century. This is what we try to do here. Okay, so in this unit, we go through especially morphology, but also, as I said, the interconnection between morphology and other areas. The basic names of these, I was saying that you don't need to learn by heart all these. There are many, many names in linguistics, but there are some basic names that as linguists or as philologists we need to know. For instance, everybody has heard of Chomsky, everybody has heard of Van Veelen, Dick, Saussure, Cosseriu, and in morphology, and especially related to Old English, we have Marchand and Kastowski from the 70s, who are, let's say, the fathers of the studies of morphology, and the ones who started with the idea of zero derivation. And they are the fathers of morphological analysis because they analyze word formation phenomena in a synchronic way. There are two ways of analyzing the evolution of a language. The diachronic methods, which you will see in other courses of this degree, as you know. And then it is easy to see, okay, this item, this lexical item has become within 100 years later, it is mentioned as this. So we see the evolution through analyzing the dictionaries and the old sources, and we can see how they evolve. The other way is the synchronic method. Synchronic method means that we analyze a word without looking back in time. This synchronic analysis of word formation has to do with several strategies and several phenomena. We can analyze the easy ones, which are the transparent word formation phenomena. Here you have the typical example of drive. From drive, we have driver, driving. So here we have a clear derivation phenomena, derivational phenomena with suffixes, right? So this is a transparent word formation phenomena because we can clearly see a suffix that is added to a base, and then another word is created. But we also have zero derivation, which is the same as non-transparent derivation phenomena, or which is also called opaque word formation phenomena. For instance, nowadays an example would be bus. Bus is a noun, but it has also become a verb. English is a very typical language where they make verbs out of everything. So, for instance, they can say, I bus the kids to school. This is a verbalization of a noun. Sometimes we do the opposite. We have nominalizations. But there is a tendency in English to make verbs out of everything. It is a very interesting phenomenon in language. In order to understand word formation phenomena in a synchronic way, Marchand developed already in the 60s two types of criteria. Content-dependent criteria and form-dependent criteria. Content-dependent criteria means that he pays attention at the meaning of the items. And form-related criteria have to do more with the morphology, the pronunciation, etc. So first we will go to the content-dependent criteria. There he designed two principles. The principle of semantic dependency, where he says, the word, if we have two words that have the same shape, for instance, so as a noun and so as a verb, this is an example we have in the book, then the word that is dependent on the content of the other for its definition is the derived word. For instance, so in this case is a verb, which is to cut, it has to do with cutting a source. With what? With a saw. So we need the idea of the concept of a saw as a noun, of the object saw, to understand that what we are doing. The same as bus, the previous example. I bus the kids to school is I take the kids to school by bus, right? So bus as a verb is obviously derived in this case, if we are, if we focus on this semantic dependency principle, bus as a verb is derived from bus as a noun. Other examples, for instance, would be with drive, with drink. What is more, where is the derived here? What is the derived word here? The drink as a noun or the verb drink? This is a bit more difficult because both verb and noun are very general. Sometimes when it is difficult to distinguish, we can go to the second principle, because not all principles need to abide. Sometimes, in some words, one of the principles is not applicable. With drink, I would not have really a clear idea of which one is, as in bus. I pass the kids to school, obviously it comes from bus. Also because bus as a verb is much more recent than drink as a verb, because drink as a verb already existed in Old English, which was drinken, one type of English verb. diachronically, I can't give you the answer. It is a verb that derived of the noun. But if we don't want to look at the history of that word, the verb and the noun are not so clear here. So what do? We go to the principle of semantic range. This says, of two homophonous words exhibiting similar sets of semantic features, the one with the smaller fit of reference, so the most hyponymic, will be, the more specific word will be the derivative. So in this case, we would have to see which one is more specific, drink as a verb or drink as a drink. Drink as a drink is very general because it has to do with all kinds of drinks, right? A beverage would be even more hyperonymic, but where with the idea of drinking, which has to do with drinking a drink, taking a drink, is a bit more. It's also quite general. In this case, I think we would have to go to the diachronic analysis, although we can say, I drink a drink, right? And we want to go to the semantic dependency principle. With the principle of the semantic range, Both are quite general in this case. So this was a difficult example. With drive, for instance, it is not so difficult because, for instance, when we have this, the series in the United States, Mulholland Drive, for instance, a drive is a type of pavement, a paveway, let's say. We have a road, a street, different types of pedestrian areas or driving areas, and drive is a specific type of area where you can drive a car, actually. So in this case, we could say that drive as a noun is more specific than drive as a verb. In this case, we would say that according to the principle of semantic range, drive as a noun is derived from drive as a verb. These content-dependent criteria, as I say, and these two principles are not always 100% useful, because sometimes, as with the verb drink and the noun drink, it is difficult to see only with these principles. So then we have to recur to the form-related criteria, although form-related criteria have more to do with compounds, not with zero derivation. Then we need to resort to history, to the diachronic analysis. But it is true that when we don't have diachronic analysis at hand, they can be very, very helpful. form-related criteria, they are mentioned in Stekauer, who is a big analyst of morphology. There are three main principles. One is the principle of phonetic shape, which says that a certain phonetic shape may put a word into a definite word class. This is a very simple criterion. But that works only for very exceptional words. Sorry, for instance, the suffix meant, I didn't even include an example that is not mentioned by him because it was very difficult for me to find. For instance, meant is a typical noun suffix. Then the principle says, the very few verbs ending in ment will be derived from noun, from the noun. For instance, ferment or torment. When you look up a word in English, in an English thesaurus or in a lexicological database, and you look for a word that finishes in ment that is not a verb, I think these ones are the very few ones that are verbs. So in this case, we can say that this is a verbalization, lexicalization of a noun. This would be the principle of phonetic shape. The principle of morphological type and the stress criterion, which are the other two, are more for compounds. They were for compounds, okay? So in compounds, sometimes we have exceptions. Normally, the base of the word will be always the right word on the right. But sometimes it turns out that it's the left one. So this principle of morphological type helps to identify the head of this compound. The head means the original head, because in compounds, how do you know which one comes first? If they are compounds, they are not derivatives. By identifying the head semantically and morphologically. So in this case, sometimes, as I said, we have these principles to make this distinction. For instance, we have average compounds such as snowball or blacklist, where the head is the second word, the word on the right, and it is a noun. So the base, the compound, is a noun as a category, and the base is also a noun, such as blacklist or snowball. In compounds, mostly the noun is the base, but we have exceptions such as babysit. In babysit, the exception is that in compounds, as I was saying, basically the base is the head of the compound is on the right, but there are exceptions. The exception is, for instance, in babysit or in lunch break. In babysit or lunch break, the base is on the left. And this principle of morphological type justifies this by saying that normally the primary the base will be a noun. So if in babysit, the whole word, the compound is a verb as a whole, but the noun is baby. So they will say, this principle would say, okay, then in the base is not sit, is baby. You understand what I mean? Because it's getting a bit complicated for me to explain, but I hope I can manage to express my idea. This works for exceptions, as I said, because in general, the base is the right word. But in exceptions such as this, when there is a doubt, we say, okay, normally in compounds, the base is a noun. In this case, lunch is the noun in lunch break. So the base of the compound is lunch. It is not break. In babysit, the base is baby. So it is baby is the base. For instance, in lunch break, we can say that break could be a verb. But in this case, we know that it is a noun. The break as a part of the compound also, and as a compound itself, lunch break would be a noun. But in this case, the base is on the left. And finally, we have the stress criterion. So here we abide by all the principles: phonetics, prosody, and morphology. The stress criterion, which also works for compounds, can also indicate what came first. It can indicate the relationship between a substantive and a verb. This is between a noun and a verb, or a prefix and a verb, or in this case, a preposition. For instance, we have underestimate is a preposition, where we have a secondary stress, which is under, and then the strong stress, which would be estimate or interact, where we have a secondary stress and the strong action, the higher stress, the strong stress, primary stress, which is in act. In compound nouns, the heavy stress is on the first element. For instance, in some compounds, nouns, outhouse, underwear, undercurrent. This principle says that verbs carrying this pattern are derived from nouns, which means that in outhouse, it is house, the base. In undercurrent, current is the base. In underwear, where would be the, in this case, underwear, the base, in this case, this principle wouldn't abide because wear is a noun. It's a verb, sorry. So in this case, it could be under. Okay, so from these principles that I say, as I said, not all of them have to work. Sometimes it is difficult to have words that abide by all the principles. But as long as there is one or two principles that works, we can find some justification. So with all these principles, what you can do is to put them into practice. And how do we put them into practice? Analyzing the derivative or derivational chains of words. We have the example in the book, going, outgoing. And we would need to analyze, for instance, the practice in the book says, okay, let's analyze outgoing. Outgoing, what is first? In this case, the derivative chain works, is a way of seeing visually the derivational process of a word. So that's how we represent it. We would write the stem, let's say go would be the stem of going, and then the stem of going would be the stem of outgoing. This is the derivative chain I would propose. In this case, the principle of phonetic shape would say that ing is a typical ending of adjectives. So if this word is an adjective, the prefix out has probably been added secondly to outgoing, because the adjective is still outgoing, is still is an adjective. Let's say so. Out is probably added afterwards. This is what this principle would say. The stress criterion would say that the heavy accent would be in going. In this case, this is how it works. Instead of out, which would be the weak stress, the heavy stress would be ongoing. So this principle would apply also for according to the stress criterion. But for the morphological criterion, which says that most compound forms come from nouns, in this case, it does not apply. So we have two principles that apply for this derivative chain that I proposed. We could try another derivative chain, which would be from go, there is outgo, and then from outgo, outgoing was created. Could this happen according to linguistic rules? Yes. Did it happen? We don't know. How do we check? Through these principles, and also we can check also through the most frequent item, the frequency of the item, which is more related to the content-dependent criteria. The content-dependent criteria was saying, as you, if you remember what we said, that the most specific a word is, the more derivative it is. This has to do with frequency of occurrence also. And a very common trick, a very simple trick, is just check for these words in Google. You just type the word in Google, and then it says, for instance, 1 million, it gives you the results, the amount of times this item appears on their database. Why do I always suggest Google? Because Google is the biggest knowledge database in the world. You can also check in other search engines, of course, but Google they have their own projects also for language data, such as Ngram, etc. So it is just simple, but you can also use other search engines. You just click on the word, and then you say, okay, what is more common, outgoing or outgo? Does outgo appear? Outgo, probably there. It doesn't almost appear, but outgoing is much more frequent than outgo. So according to this, outgoing, outgo cannot be the base of outgoing. Yeah. Okay. It has to be the other way around. Other examples, for instance, that we could put into practice. For instance, breathtaking, heartbreaking, heartbreaker. This is examples I invite you to think about. For instance, for breathtaking, heartbreaking or heartbreaker, for instance, there, because I included both derivational suffixes with ing or with er, which implies more, as you know, an action or a quality. With heartbreaking, we have both a compound and a derivational suffix. So, heart. And then we have break, and then breaking. If we check for the word, for instance, heartbreak in Google, it exists. We look it up in the dictionary. It exists. It exists. But what is more common, to say heartbreaking or heartbreak? Heartbreaking is more common. So it is difficult that heartbreak can be the derivative of heartbreaking, probably from breaking that later on has heart has been added. This if we take a look at the frequency or the content dependent criteria. But if we look at the stress criterion or the phonetic shape, we would say that the ing is a typical ending of adjectives, so the prefix heart in this case is probably added after having added breaking. Okay, these are some examples of that we can apply. In this case, break is also a verb. The base would be hard, or would it be break? In this case, the base would be hard, probably because the content of the whole compound has to do with breaking the heart. But we can also say that for heartbreaking, the concept, the idea of morphological type does not apply. If we want to say, okay, the base, if the base, we consider the base to be break, break is not a noun, so then it does not apply. When there are doubts between which one is the base, break or heart, we just check for frequencies in Google, which is the other trick, as I said. So these are just some little examples on how to analyze derivations through synchronic methods. Okay, but of course you can always recur to etymological dictionaries. Later on, I will show you a very interesting database that I found, where you can just look for the word in Old English and then diachronically check whether your derivative chain complies with the past. Okay, so going to the next point. Now we have in the book, in the unit, we have basic concepts for this unit, which is just very briefly. I'm going to go through it very briefly, and if you have any doubts, please ask. There are two types of analysis of linguistic semantics: lexical semantics and truth conditional semantics. Which is the one we are using here? Obviously, lexical semantics, because lexical semantics analyzes the lexicon. Lexical semantics uses the word as their unit of study and considers words to have meaning on their own, obviously. It is different from truth conditional semantics, which is called formal semantics, where the unit of study is the sentences. So the content of words is defined in terms of their contribution to the sentence. And this type of formal semantics is very interesting, and it has also been applied to many ontological databases, etc. But this is not what we are going to analyze here in this unit. Okay, in this unit we are going to see the relationship of morphology with lexical semantics, because that's where there is an interconnection. Morphology deals with word meaning. Word grammar, and lexical semantics deals with word meaning. So lexical semantics is very interconnected with morphology, because both of them analyze words and they use the word that is the lexicon as their unit of study, and that's why they can work together in the development of lexicological databases, lexicographical works, thesauri, all types of instruments, terminological databases, and formal semantics would be more related to other types of linguistic tools, such as ontologies, for instance. Although ontologies are also part of the study of lexical semantics, we will see this more in detail in further units. Truth conditional semantics is more related to formal logic and philosophy, and with the notion of truth, and they use a lot more the meta language that we saw in Unit 1 that is adopted from mathematics or logics. And something important of these basic concepts is the following concepts that we have here: lexeme, stem, and lemma. First of all, we will start with the most basic one, which is word. A word is a lexical item. So a word is very simple. A lexical unit. It is a concrete unit of morphological analysis. A word is what we see. Everything we see is a word. With this space between one word and another, this is a word. Car, driver, sun, sunny. It doesn't matter whether it is derived or not. This is a word. Okay? Lexeme, however, is a basic lexical unit of language, which can be also composed of several words. For instance, compound words that are not joined together, acronyms. A lexeme is an abstract unit of morphological analysis. And why is it abstract? Because it is used to represent a whole system of morphological inflections and derivations of a certain item. A lexical unit, for instance, drive. The idea of drive, the lexical unit of drive, is not composed of only the word drive. It's composed of all the words that compose the inflections and the derivations of drive, such as driver, driving, drives, drove. So in this case, drive is more than one word, and the elixim comprises all of them. Elixim normally is represented with capital letters, as we see here. Okay, so in order to distinguish elixim from elema, which is also something very confusing sometimes, we can say that elema is in normal letters and elixim is in capital letters. Lemma is the canonical form or a dictionary form or a citation form of a set of words. So, why is it different from elixim? Because elixim contains, it's an abstract lexical unit, first of all, and the lemma is a representation. Is the word the form that represents this lexeme and that is used to organize this lexeme in, for instance, a dictionary or in a terminology. So when we determine which lemma citation form, it is what we are going to refer to, for instance, with driver, drive, driving, etc. Drive will be the lemma for the whole lexeme. And that's what we will find in the dictionary. But for instance, driver can also be a lemma. It will be a driver of other inflective forms such as drivers. Driver can also be a lemma because it will appear on the dictionary. Okay? So that's why a lemma and a lexeme do not always coincide, because within a lexeme we can have different lemmas. A lemma is, let's say, the head of a family of words that are inflected, the inflected word forms of a given root, let's say. So from a root, we have several inflections. They are all the word forms that are inflected from this root. They are they contain all this family. All these inflections are in a dictionary within an entry, and this entry is represented by one of these forms, the form that we use to represent all these inflected word forms is going to be the lemma. So here we have another concept that appears, which is root, and root tends to be confounded with stem. Stem and root are different. Why? Because the root is really the base of a form of a word. The root is the smallest unit of analysis in morphology, together with a prefix or a suffix. But we have roots, prefixes, and affixes. But a root is a free morpheme. Is the smallest unit of lexical analysis, and morpheme can be a suffix, an affix, or a root. What is the different? Normally, it is represented with the with a hyphen. For instance, you have here down at the end of the slide, you have the root of driver is drive with a hyphen. This is the root. Stem is not represented with a hyphen because a stem is a portion of the word where we can add more inflections. So it is a form to which more affixes can be added. So for instance, we take the word drivers. In drivers, the lemma is driver. Not drive, but driver. Because drivers derives from driver. The stem is also driver. Because from driver, drivers stem. And the root is drive, drift, with a hyphen. Because from there we have driving, driver, drives, drove. So the root is one, but there can be many stems. For instance, from the stem driver, we have drivers. From drivers, the stem is drive, But if we take driver and we analyze this word, this is also a derived word where er, the suffix is er, and drive, in this case, is the stem. So driver also has a stem. So a word can have several stems if we start to demounted, decomposed. Okay, it could be a bit as the compositional sentence analysis. We can also decompose words into different stems. So I hope this is clear, because I saw that in the book, although for future editions we will revise this, we include lexeme, stem, and lemma, but then we don't talk about the stem. Sorry, stem, not stem. Or root. But this is important also, to establish a difference between stem and root. And this is a web page. I cannot click now. Lexilogos, that I highly recommend you. You will have it in the PowerPoint. Lexilogos is created by a French author, but you can find it also in English. In this web page, you have anything you want to do, you want to see about dictionaries of in different languages, in English, in French, there are three or four more languages. You have also etymological dictionaries. You have, for instance, from for all English, the Wordsworth and Toller. You have thesauri, glossaries. So I really recommend you to check this database. And because the developer is French, he also has a lot of collection of specific dialects from France. So it is a really, really an interesting language webpage. Sorry. and finally, in this section of the course, we have two concepts that are interesting. So that if you read them in the future, you know what they are. They are quoted by Prandi, who says that the lexicon of natural languages contains two kinds of concepts, endocentric concepts or exocentric concepts. What is the difference between them? Endocentric concepts are the ones whose identity are more dependent on specific lexical structures, so they are more language-specific. And these endocentric concepts will be normally the basis for the development of a specialized lexicon or of terminological databases, of terminological research. Exocentric concepts are more independent from lexicalization and from categorization. And they are more cross-linguistics. For instance, an exocentric concept would be the concept of mother. This is what we could call a universal concept. And in fact, these concepts are surprisingly very similar in shape, in general, not always, but in shape. In this case, for instance, because they all come from Indo-European, but we can have other concepts that are very cross-linguistic, not only because they come from Indo-European, but because of this, but because they are more exocentric concepts, such as the a universal concept of mother. All the concepts related to the family, father, also mother, have very similar expressions, the form. We can say that in this case, the lexical structure will be more independent from a specific language. And they will be more related to universal categorizations. So, for instance, a terminological research or terminological database will be more focused in general on language-specific concepts, which will develop specific terms. But exocentric concepts are also very important, for instance, in the standardization or in the development of different types of ontologies. Okay. Okay, so in point five, we have a small introduction to something that can be the base for everything you do in linguistics, which is establishing units of analysis and levels of language. So here is a representation. Dick, in 1997, when he wrote the big blue book of functional and introduction to functional grammar, which you will probably have seen in other courses of the degree, designed a representation of the levels of language, but he forgot to include morphology. So this is an adaptation of his own device, of his own drawing, let's say. And what is interesting in here is that we have different levels of analysis, different levels in language, and the more to the center we go, the more to the point, to the core of language, the more universal the features of this analysis, or this the more universal these features of language are, so the more cross-linguistic, and the more outside we go, the more culturally dependent they are, or more idiosyncratic, as we call them. So, for instance, phonology means the study of phonology. In phonology, we study sounds. All languages have sounds, all languages have vowels. We make use of our mouths. We all have the same instruments to talk, which is our vocal cords, our brain to pronounce words, etc. How then we apply this to a language or another is different, but we have a specific and very limited amount of sounds available in all languages. And some languages make use of more sounds than others, but it is true that phonology and the rules of phonology abide for all languages. So we can say that phonology is universal. Then we have the level that Dick didn't include of morphology. He went directly to syntax. Morphology and syntax have to do with the structure of language. The only difference is that morphology deals with the structure of words and syntax deals with the structure of sentences. But they have to do also, they also analyze the underlying structure and the underlying mechanisms of language and language development and language change. So that's why I included these arrows, because they are interconnected. In fact, when you study grammar, you also we have a discipline which is called morphosyntax, exactly because of this, because we are doing dealing with structures, underlying structures. And interestingly, when we analyze the structure of words and the grammar words, we realize that it can be analyzed with the same devices as when we analyze the syntax of words. In morphology, we have in words, we have a base form, we have sub forms that depend on the base. These sub forms, or it's like having a sentence with a subordinate clause and a main clause, and the subordinate clause modifies the main clause by adding I don't know which modality. So in morphology, is the same, but with words. This is also more cross-linguistic than semantics. So, of course, here we start to see differences. We have, for instance, subject, object, verb languages, or subject, verb, object languages. We have inflectional languages, derivational languages, ideographic languages, languages that use to understand the grammar. We need focus on word order, or languages that are very highly inflected. Word order is more relaxed because the grammar, the grammatical information is provided through the morphology of the language. So there are many ways to express this on the surface. Okay. But this is still, let's say, as Chomsky declared, the underlying structures are universal. And then which structures of these available are used by one language or the other, this is what is idiosyncratic. Okay? But now when we continue to semantics is actually what shows that language is a conceptual phenomenon. Semantics is much more connected to the reality of the speakers. It has to do with concepts. And the reality that surrounds us will give us the concepts that we will later on want to represent, right? So that's what we were saying, for instance, on the first day about the amount of words that exist in France to mention, to refer to bread. Or an example we have on this second unit is from the book a mandatory book for linguists, which is from Lakoff, Women, Fire and Dangerous Things. I don't know if you read that book. It is very interesting. It's from the 80s. And he was saying, Lakoff, he gave an example, for instance, of a language where, I don't remember which language, where there are only three colors, black, red and white. Because the speakers of that language probably don't need any more colors. So they didn't create the term to name other colors. And the reality is shaped through only three colors. So this is really interesting to see how cultures define reality and design reality through language. And here comes the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, or the dilemma in language. What is first, the concept or language? This is something that has been studied by now, and I wrote in the book, in the course book, that for me this mystery is still unsolved. Although we have defendants of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis and other defendants of the conceptual hypothesis. Some linguists think that the concept is first, and that in fact the language is a conceptual phenomenon, as Lakoff was defending, and all the cognitivist theorists, and others that think that language can also shape reality. I think it can be maybe just both in a way, but I don't know. It can be both. I still wouldn't go for any of them 100%, because it is, for instance, with chauvinistic language. This is just a personal example, but for instance, for me, it's very interesting as a linguist to see how in Spain we are creating words to avoid gender differences between A and O, because O is the collective ending for masculine and feminine. So we say muchos amigos when we refer to amigas and amigos, and then we say muchas amigues. But semantically, we keep on saying que coñazo or esto es cojonudo. So we don't realize that coñazo comes from the woman and cojonudo comes from the man. And there are many items, many examples in our language that we should change first that have to do with the lexicon and not with the grammar. For instance, so in this case, for instance, we see that society is changing and society is trying to change the language. But to which point, if we don't change the lexicon, is society going to change? And also, there are societies where there is no gender, gender is not grammatical. For instance, in English, and this does not mean that English-speaking countries have less chauvinistic societies than Spanish-speaking countries, even if their syntax and their morphology does not express gender. So, okay, I went a bit sideways, but I would like to hear your opinion about this, because it has to do with these levels. And you can write them now or in the forum if you want. It would be very interesting to raise a discussion on this. And finally, what is completely related to the culture of a language and this very idiosyncratic is pragmatics. Pragmatics is the study in language that has to do with the intentions of the speaker. So obviously, it is the most connected to the external world. So in this circle, the more outside we go to the circle, the more we are connecting to the external world, to the speakers. And in this case, the pragmatics is totally related to the speakers. Semantics also reflects idiosyncratic features of languages, and syntax and morphology also, as we see, for instance, in the example I just gave you, but in, let's say, less strong way, and it is more difficult to adapt to change a language through changing syntax and morphology. These structures of language have more to do with the linguistic evolution, with other rules that are part of language change, such as the principle of minimum effort, phonetic rules, which you will see in other units of the degree. My point is, if we want to change a society, let's go first for the easy part, which is changing the concept, the lexical representation, the lexemes, the words, the sentences, the semantics. It is, for instance, with vegans. The father of my child is vegan, and when I said, "Oh, madam, let's kill two birds in one shot," and he was saying, "Oh, careful," and I was like, "Now I became much more aware of the expressions we have in our language and in other languages that are not respectful with animals." So now I try to use other, but sometimes it comes, such as coger el toro por los cuernos. This, instead of coger la sartén por el mango, which is the same, but without having to use an animal. So let's say that this is what makes me more aware of my reality than morphology and syntax, because it is connected to our reality. So here you have it in the book, in the course also, so I'm not going to go very quickly through it. It is adapted from Fernandez, 1996. You have the reference also in the book, the different subsystems of language and their units of analysis. What is interesting here is that, as you can see, morphemes are studied both by morphology and by semantics. So this unit of analysis is part of both. That's why they are interconnected, semantics and morphology. And for morphology in dictionaries, you have a reference in the book that in future editions we will update. Here I include it as an example, and I encourage you to check further. In the PowerPoint, you can access the link, and you have more information in the comments of the PowerPoint that you can download. This section for morphology in dictionaries is very interesting in Wikipedia. Why do I include a Wikipedia entry? Because we have to stop demonizing Wikipedia as a bad source in academy. What we need is to have a good criterion to distinguish what is good quality information from bad quality information. But Wikipedia is a wonderful source of knowledge. In this case, for instance, the entry for morphology in dictionaries is wonderful, and I encourage you to read it. It just talks about different types of dictionaries, the ones where you have the morphological analysis is directly in the entries with specific non-language dependent symbols, which are called morpheme-aligned dictionaries, and then you have full-form non-aligned dictionaries. Full-form dictionaries would be dictionaries where we have the form of the word as we can read it now, and morpheme-aligned dictionaries, which are very complex, and these kind of dictionaries are used in the development of lexicological databases, lexicological studies, etc. They can be used to analyze part of a speech, gender, number, all types of morphological features. Okay. So go through it, and if you have any doubts, just let me know. And a very interesting also is, just to finish, lexicological resources. I included here a few more lexicological resources that you have in the book, because there are more and more appearing day by day. I include here incredibly amazing website, which is Linguistic Data Consortium, which is an American database that is developed by many companies and universities. it started in the University of Pennsylvania, but there are many, many contributors. The downside of it is that many of the resources they have there are with subscription. But there are also many, many other resources that are free. Celex Corpus is not free anymore, unfortunately. You can check the information for the Celex corpus in the in this other link. But I encourage you to check the link to see the amazing amount of databases they have, lexical analysis, lexical projects, etc. Corpora are also very basic tools that we all need as linguists. The traditional British National Corpus is still there. It will always be there, thank God. But we have also many English corpora. In this webpage, which I added, there is this COCA corpus, the Corpus of Contemporary American English, where as you, for instance, when I have used corpora, for me, a very interesting search for in corpora is not only frequency of use of a specific word, but also, for instance, keyword in context to see. This is called quick search. Keyword in context is a typical type of search in corpora to see what is the frequency of occurrence of two items together, for instance, for with phrasal verbs, for instance, or prepositions with specific verbs. Depending on the type of analysis and study we want to carry on, the co-occurrences are something that corpora allow us to search for in a very interesting way. The lexicological database of Old English that was developed in the University of La Rioja a few years ago, which was called NERTHUS Project, and NERTHUS was the original name of the corpus, now has changed to Parallel Corpus Old English English. Before in NERTHUS, you have a complete analysis of the lexical items of the English language, verbs, adjectives, nouns, and adverbs, under derivational features, which is what I did when I participated in this project as regards to Old English verbs, to analyze all the suffixes of the English verbs and their derivative chain of verb by verb. Imagine the work, but it was very interesting. It was created with FileMaker, and now there are other instruments that are used. If you want to know more about how this lexicological database and this parallel corpus of Old English English was created, there is a talk in the course book from Martin Javier Arista, who is the main developer of this project, from the University of La Rioja, where he talks about the resources, the technological resources that were used, and the searches that can be done, and also the theoretical framework in which this is based. WordNet is a classic, and in WordNet, where you have a framework for the analysis of words regarding concepts, lexical relationships, and ontologies, etc. They have included also now an interesting database that lists all the related projects that have to do with the analysis of words as nets of words, of lexical nets and frameworks. So there you can also access many other projects. Lexilogos is the page I was mentioning, where you have a very big database of all types of dictionaries of different languages, of different ages, not only dictionaries, thesauri, glossaries, conceptual databases, terminological databases. And finally, the Institute for Dutch Lexicology, although it has to do with Dutch, it is very interesting to see how they work and the projects they are carrying out. It could be interesting for maybe in case you want in the future to further research on the world of lexicology. There, they have also publications on there where they talk about their framework, their methodology of work, their working methodologies, etc. So I encourage you also to check it. Okay. And that was all. Thanks for watching and listening. If you have any doubts, I can answer them now or in the forum of Unit 2. Thank you.